Thank you, Ed. Our next panelist is Jonathan Marshall. Jonathan's a research fellow at the Independent Institute. His many books on foreign affairs include To Have and Have Not, Southeast Asian Raw Materials and the Origins of the Pacific War, Drug Wars, the Iran-Contra Connection, and Cocaine Politics. Jonathan?
Thank you very much. Well, sadly, Vietnam wasn't the only war sustained by government lies and half-truths. I'd like to spend just a few minutes reminding you of a few of the lies and distortions from the 1990-91 Gulf War, because they form the backdrop for the second Bush administration's threatened policy of war today. The first myth was that Iraq's invasion of Kuwait demonstrated aggressive ambitions akin to those of Hitler's Germany. In 1990, President Bush likened the invasion of Kuwait to Hitler's occupation of the Rhineland, the first step towards World War II. You hear a similar refrain today from George W.'s administration. Well, it certainly was aggression, it was unjustified, but it was hardly part of a master plan of regional conquest. Indeed, one scholar has likened the invasion of Kuwait to India's 1961 invasion of the Portuguese colony of Goa, which attracted hardly a peep of international protest. In fact, long before Saddam ever got on the scene, Iraqi leaders and the public had rejected the borders that Great Britain drew in 1922, defining the borders of Iraq and Kuwait, which basically limited Iraq's access to the sea. More immediately, Iraq resented bearing the financial burden of the war against Iran, which it viewed as protecting the Gulf states from Shiite expansionism. And it resented Kuwait's overproduction of oil, which drove down the price of oil and drained Iraq's treasury. It demanded that Kuwait forgive war debts, hand over an oil field that Kuwait was draining, even though most of the oil field lay within Iraq's territory. And it asked for a small island, which would have given it access to the sea. All it got were Kuwaiti diplomatic snubs. Interestingly, when Iraq finally did invade on August 2, 1990, Saudi Arabia's King Fahd blamed Kuwaiti intransigence for Iraq's invasion. And when the National Security Council met that day to discuss the situation, there weren't any particular protests. As one participant put it, the attitude was, hey, too bad about Kuwait, but it's just a gas station, and who cares whether the sign says Sinclair or Exxon? At the same time, Jordan's King Hussein told the president that Saddam was planning to withdraw from Kuwait within a few days. And indeed, Arab leaders put together a plan which would have had Iraq annex a very thin slice of Kuwaiti territory and quickly withdraw. But then, unfortunately, President Bush ran into Margaret Thatcher at a conference at the Aspen Institute. And she, perhaps heady from her days with the Falkland War, convinced Bush that as leader of the free world, he couldn't stand by while naked aggression went unchecked, that it was his duty to stand up to it the way that Chamberlain had failed to in the 1930s. And Bush then started a rhetorical rampage denouncing Saddam's intolerable invasion and naked aggression, exactly the kind of rhetoric that, in fact, Arab leaders had warned him against if they wanted to see Saddam withdraw quietly. Quickly, the administration went on the diplomatic offensive to sabotage the peace plan worked out by Arab leaders, the neighbors of Iraq, to get Saddam out of Kuwait. Well, derailing a diplomatic solution allowed the Iraq crisis to become the rallying cry for a much more expansive foreign policy. As Bush declared, if history teaches us anything, it is that we must resist aggression or it will destroy freedoms. On a rather ironic date, September 11, 1990, Bush said that the Persian Gulf crisis offered a rare opportunity to create a new world order free from the threat of terror, rhetoric which has a little certain ring to it today. His premise was that, quote, the United States henceforth would be obligated to lead the world community to an unprecedented degree in pursuit of our national interests. Bush wrote in his diary in November 1990, our role as a world leader will once again be reaffirmed, but if we compromise and if we fail, we would be reduced to total impotence, and that is not going to happen. I don't care if I have one vote in Congress, that will not happen. Well, to justify such rhetoric and such expansive aims, it became necessary to claim that much more was at stake than just jobs, 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 as one administration official put it, or to claim that we were defending democracy in the feudal emirate, which had just a few months earlier arrested a bunch of pro-democracy demonstrators. They needed some much bigger threats. Well, one of the many claims that was made was that Iraq represented an imminent threat to Saudi Arabia and its oil fields, thus posing a major strategic issue for the United States, Western Europe, Japan, and so forth. Then Defense Secretary Dick Cheney and Colin Powell both started working the press. Within days, the New York Times and Washington Post both ran stories based on leaked administration information that Iraqi troops were poised on the border of Saudi Arabia to invade. And as one historian says, the news had been deliberately doctored, despite the fact that at no time did either the Central Intelligence Agency or the Defense Intelligence Agency believe it probable that Iraq would invade Saudi Arabia. Shades of what Dan Ellsberg has been telling us about Vietnam. In September 1990, the U.S. claimed that Iraq had 250,000 troops on the Saudi border ready to invade. By January, that number had been inflated to more than 500,000. Most of the American media bought this without question, because, of course, the government doesn't lie. Well, the St. Petersburg Times went out and purchased some commercial satellite photographs of the border region and couldn't find any Iraqi troops poised on the border. But given the choice between believing the photographs and the administration, the American media chose to believe the administration. Needless to say, the lies worked. We invaded. We won quickly. And this brings me to the third myth I want to address, which is that this was a basically a low-cost, surgically precise war. We'll put aside the fact that it cost over $100 billion, but I think the public's perception was heavily influenced by the idea that this war was marked by the expert use of precision weapons with pinpoint accuracy to eliminate so-called collateral damage. American TV showed over and over again footage of cruise missiles homing in on their targets, without mentioning that much of the destruction wreaked on Iraq was done by old-fashioned B-52 bombers and their carpet bombing. A mere 7% of all the munitions dropped on Iraq were so-called smart munitions. In all, the United States dropped 142,000 tons of bombs on Iraq and Kuwait in 43 days. Their targets weren't all tanks out in the desert, either. As the Washington Post reported well after the war, I might add, U.S.-led forces, quote, sought to achieve some of their military objectives by disabling Iraqi society at large. Because of these goals, damage to civilian structures and interests, invariably described by briefers during the war as collateral and unintended, were sometimes neither. A United Nations survey in March 1991, after the war, described the bombing of Iraq as, quote, near apocalyptic, and said it threatened to reduce, quote, a rather highly urbanized and mechanized society to a pre-industrial age. The next month, a 12-member Harvard study team concluded, in the words of one member, quote, there was a public health catastrophe due to the cumulative effects of the Allied bombing and resulting sanctions. The United States destroyed the country's electrical system, its factories, bridges, highways, railroads, communications facilities, the entire infrastructure of modern industrial life. Of the casualty counts, a mere 79 Americans were killed in action. The U.S. military refused to estimate the number of Iraqi dead. But in January of 1992, the U.S. Census Bureau produced a study concluding that the Iraqis had lost 145,000 dead. About 5,000 civilians who died in the immediate war, about 40,000 military personnel killed, and 100,000 civilians who died in the immediate aftermath of the war due to violence and health conditions. The war produced more than 5 million refugees, and subsequent sanctions killed more than 500,000 Iraqis, according to the Food and Agriculture Organization and other international bodies. These are the kinds of so-called collateral damage that we can look forward to if the United States wages war once again in Iraq based on more lives of the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Our final panelist is David Henderson. David is Associate Professor of Economics at the Naval Postgraduate School and Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution. Professor Henderson received his PhD in economics from UCLA, and he served as senior economist for the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Among David's books is the book The Joy of Freedom, and there's also copies of this in the front, which I also highly recommend. It's a real pleasure to have David Henderson.
Thank you. I know a lot of you are walking out. I know it's been a long night. Here's my promise to you. I will keep this under 6 minutes. I've been an economist over half my life. The more I've learned, the more I've seen what a powerful insight economist Ludwig von Mises had over 50 years ago when he pointed out that virtually every government intervention leads to bad consequences that then cause government to intervene further. So, for example, that wasn't even an applause line, but thank you. So, for example, Nixon's 1973 price controls on gasoline caused us to line up for gas. That led the government to dictate the fuel economy of cars. The fuel economy laws caused auto companies to make lighter cars, causing a few extra thousand deaths a year. That's all documented, by the way, in my book, The Joy of Freedom. That's not the joy part, by the way. The gasoline lineups also caused people to be more sympathetic to intervening in the Middle East. In foreign policy also, when government intervenes, it creates problems that it tries to solve by intervening further. Take Iraq. If I were Henny Youngman, I'd say please, but okay. How did we get to the current situation where the Bush administration wants to take out Saddam Hussein? Let's take a trip down memory lane. In 1963, the CIA helped a young Iraqi ally who, along with other plotters, overthrew General Abdul Qasim. You may have heard of this young Iraqi ally. We've been talking about him a bit this evening. His name was Saddam Hussein. 5 years later, the CIA backed another coup that made Hussein deputy to the new military ruler. In 1979, Hussein took his turn as dictator. Hussein proceeded to make a long and costly war on Iran. Although many people point to this war as evidence of Hussein's evil, they rarely mention one highly relevant fact. The Reagan administration, of which, by the way, I was a part, but I had nothing to do with this one, supported this invasion with millions of dollars in export credits and with satellite intelligence. Saddam Hussein was evil for initiating and fighting that war. How then should we think about the US government for actively supporting him? But my main purpose here is not to question the morality of war. Rather, it's to point out how one intervention leads to another. The US government supported a man who then took over Iraq's government and who has now become our enemy. The US government's interventions of the 1960s led to the planned intervention today. Why did the US support Saddam Hussein in his war in Iran? Because Iran had become a U.S. enemy after Khomeini took over and after the Iranians had taken people in our embassy hostage in 1979. One reason many Iranians hated the U.S. government was that they resented the fact that the CIA, with Kermit Roosevelt and Norman Schwarzkopf Sr., that's the father, leading the charge, had deposed the democratically elected premier, Mohammad Mossadegh, in 1953 and reinstalled the Shah of Iran. The Shah proceeded to create a secret terrorist police force named SAVAK, imprison political opponents, and poisoned water wells in rural areas in order to force people into cities. Funny how that pisses people off. Or take Afghanistan. Although the U.S. government now fiercely opposes the radical Muslims who until recently ran the Afghan government, it was the U.S. government that helped put them in that position. Zbigniew Brzezinski was the National Security Advisor to President Jimmy Carter. You remember Jimmy Carter? That wonderful man who's done so much for world peace? Brzezinski now brags about the fact that he persuaded Carter in 1979 to destabilize Afghanistan's pro-Soviet government so that the Soviets would invade. In other words, that was his goal. In December 1979, Brzezinski got his Christmas wish. The Soviets invaded Afghanistan. Then the CIA proceeded to recruit radical Muslims to fight the Soviets. One of those freedom fighters was a tall guy with a funny beard named Osama bin Laden. Incidentally, the Bush administration has been trying like mad to find a link between Osama and Saddam. Here's the link. In the 1980s, both were on the U.S. government's payroll. I've got an idea. Why don't we just get our government to stop? Ah, but we can't do that, say the advocates of war with Iraq, because Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. Maybe he does or maybe he doesn't, but you don't get to be a 65-year-old dictator without a strong instinct for survival. Which means that it's hard to come up with a reasonable scenario in which Saddam Hussein tries to use his weapons on us. He well knows that if he tries to do so, and if the weapon can be traced, he would quickly be dead. The one case in which Saddam is most likely to use his weapons of mass destruction, as I pointed out in an article in July, and as CIA Director George Tenet pointed out in his letter to Senator Graham earlier this month, the one situation in which he's most likely to use these weapons is if the U.S. government invades Iraq. Aren't we taking a chance by letting him develop his weapons? Yes. But it's not different in principle from the chance we're taking with other dictators with nuclear weapons, including the dictator of Pakistan and the dictators of China. Moreover, to argue for intervening now to set up a more peaceful government in Iraq is like arguing that most government intervention in the past worked badly, but from now on, most government intervention will work really well. Not only does intervention not work, but also it's the main cause of the problem, as the cases of Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan show. The solution is not more, but less intervention. Did I say less? How about none?